Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's December 3rd, 2017, and welcome to episode 162 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and all things binary. Speaking of things binary, I am host number zero, Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and I am joined today by Jack Nutting, host number one in Stockholm. How are you, Jack?
Hi, Paul. I'm pretty good.
So, it's just us today.
Yes, not very round, although, you know, two points can also describe a circle. It can describe very many, many circles. So
That's true. Or an ellipse, right?
I think. Yeah, sure.
But
a rectangle. We could put anything on two points. Any shape we could put on 2 points.
All right, off to a good start. For some reason, you know, once again, we've only managed to get a couple of us together here, but we're hopeful that in the future we will have a rounder table here.
That's right. But we figured at this point it's better to have just two of us on an episode than have no episode at all.
Right. As people may have noticed, who are not listening to the back catalog, at least, that it has been some time between episodes recently, and so we're going to try to at least make them come out constantly.
Right.
So, all right. So another thing that we lack today, apart from a third, is a host topic, so we can go straight into a couple of listener feedback. One thing I'll mention is that Steve wrote over email to remind us of a Benj Edwards article from PC Magazine, which is 7 classic home PC follow-ups that were never released. So we'll have a link to that in the show notes. It's kind of interesting. Once you get through all the ads and things, you will discover that there were many computers that had a number one higher than the one you remembered almost released. So, it's like Commodore 65 and the Color Computer 4, yep. Aquarius 2, the TI-99-8.
They jumped up four whole numbers.
Or a quarter, it's unclear. A half?
Well, they were 4/A up to 8.
Yeah.
I guess it depends on the value of A.
At any rate. Yeah.
Sorry to bring math into this.
Yep. Oh, yeah, I was trying to figure, when we were trying to figure out a host topic, I looked up properties of 162 and found that it is a 3 smooth number. Which apparently means that it can be factored into small primes that are not larger than 3. So, if you take enough 2s and 3s and multiply them together, you can get 162.
That's awesome.
Yes, very exciting.
So smooth.
Also, we had actually a couple different fairly persistent marketing companies write to us to ask if they could sponsor a post on our website. So, no.
One of them even gave a price. Like, we might pay you as much as was like $75 or something.
Yeah. You know, they said something like, after having read your episodes page, you know, we see that we're in the same Android market space or something like this. It's like, well, I think not.
They are just so into us.
Yep.
They like all the things we like.
Like Android apps.
But, it's amazing.
All right. So perhaps we'll do more feedback next time, but that was the feedback so far. And so we'll move right into the items of interest and news, and Jack, you can start with yours.
Yeah, so Atari, good old dead zombie Atari, they announced this summer, and I think we talked about it at some point, the future console they're making called the Atari Box, which they've released some details about. It's got some custom CPU and talked about the graphics and stuff, and they say it's going to be some sort of open platform, so it's not going to be just boxed into what a vendor lets you buy, that sort of thing. You'll be able to customize, blah, blah, blah. It's going to be crowdfunded. It's going to cost $250, $300. It's not really determined. I'm very skeptical of the whole thing, but they did release in the past week or two-ish some info about this joystick that's going to be part of it, and what's cool is it looks a lot like the classic old Atari joystick, the black with the red button. This one has more of an orange button. Mm. And it connects through, I guess, Bluetooth to the device, I assume. And it's interesting because in terms of its like size and form factor, it looks very much to be like one of the classic old Atari joysticks, which makes you wonder how people today who didn't grow up with this at all will react to that. Like, what kind of games can I play that only use one button? And it's funny because back in the day when we didn't have 15 buttons on our controllers, like game designers were able to make games that were still somehow compelling and interesting at the time. Mm. So I don't know. Anyway, it looks kind of cool. It looks kind of slick.
Well, and it seems like, you know, Flappy Birds, right? I mean, you only need the button.
Right. Yeah. You just tap anywhere on the screen.
So maybe this is too many controls.
Yeah. This controller is way too complex. Yeah. So anyway, it's interesting. I'm curious to see what they come up with. I'm curious but skeptical about their crowdfunded thing. We'll see how it goes. Mm-hmm.
It looks more solid than the actual Atari joysticks, which are sort of like, I don't know, trying to play games with a pool noodle or something. But yeah.
It looks solid. It looks kind of cool. We'll see.
The actual Atari box too looks slick, but I also wonder like what the market is for this. You know, for it's going to be people like us who never bothered to get old stuff, but just kind of remembers the wood grain stuff, or I guess the hipster, you know, vinyl record buyers of today.
Right. Yeah, I guess. I mean, except this is actually like I think in terms of specs, they are claiming that the Atari box is comparable to a mid-range PC in terms of its graphics and overall performance. Mm-hmm. So like it's not something just for playing retro stuff. You can probably play like pretty sweet new games as well. But then it's a matter of they have to get some sort of developer support, like way for people to get their applications out on this piece of hardware. And that seems like something that I really doubt this company in its current form is capable of doing.
Right.
So,
I mean, I guess there's always the question of how the consoles can compete with each other anyway, but once you're playing the game, it doesn't really matter, you know, that somewhere out of your line of sight is a nice looking black box. I mean, it's the game that is going to matter.
Right.
So if it's just playing a PC game, you could just use a PC.
Right.
So, oh well.
Yeah.
But
so,
joystick's
we'll
cool.
See.
Actually, so is it clear whether, did you say this, can you use the joystick even if you don't have an Atari box?
I don't think that they've said anything about that. I would hope so. I'd hope it's kind of, you know, a more or less standard Bluetooth device somehow. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't really, what I've seen doesn't really say anything like that, anything that I've read.
Well, yeah. Continuing the mismanagement of Atari, if that's what they're going to be doing. But anyway, I guess that's sort of retro.
God forbid they tell us anything.
All right. Let's see. So the thing I had... this just came to my attention. It's actually not super new, but somebody coded. It's a digital clock implemented in Life. So in Conway's Life. So Conway's Game of Life. I assume most people have heard of this, but it's basically just a little kind of like, I don't know, biological simulator where every step sort of determines what cells on a grid live or die depending on what their neighbors are, and it turns out that you can do some pretty sophisticated things with these patterns, making little things that'll shoot across the screen, you know, moving. It sort of seems as if they're moving, at least, because the, you know, the newly born cells are off to the right and the dying ones are off to the left, and so it sort of shoots across. So you can make these gliders and spaceships, and there's various things that people have learned how to do. But so this digital clock is, I'm not actually sure how big it is. It's huge. Essentially what it does is it's created this thing essentially with the little gliders that will interact with little programmed grids such that you actually have a digital clock that starts, you know, it says 12, 10, 12, 11, 12, 12. It will actually count up. It has an AM and a PM indicator. You know, so if you just look at the part where there's, you know, the actual numbers, it looks like a clock. But if you sort of zoom out enough to actually see what's happening, it's It's really quite. It does not look like a good use of someone's time, but it's pretty cool.
Yeah, not a good use of someone's time. It's gonna strip. Yeah, it is very cool though. And it's fun to look at this and like zoom way in. It's like, wow, what in the world is going on here? I don't really understand, but it's cool.
You're learning something about how to compute things, I suppose, if you figure this out. I don't know.
Right.
And maybe it's the same kind of thing you learn playing Lemmings, right? But
it's interesting because they're like these sort of control units above the numbers. Like there's one above each digit and there's another one at the top. And those control units are somehow like they launch little floaters at each other to make things happen.
Right.
So the top thing is launching little floaters or gliders, where they're called, at the things below that control each digit. And those can shoot things down at the digit to make it light up and turn off different parts of the 7-segment display.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy, but it's pretty cool.
Yeah. There's a little thing on Stack Exchange that sort of discusses who's the user. The user is Dim, who sort of talked about making this. And apparently, from what I understood, I didn't read it too carefully, but apparently it was actually it was kind of done by trial and error, which is
nice.
Also just unbelievable. But I think there are people who really do study this, you know, mathematically and do it in a sort of academic way. But this is basically someone just hacking away at it. So anyway, it was kind of cool.
Pretty nice. Worth looking at. It's fun to zoom in and see the little parts and get some concept of, okay, these little parts all together add up to make this big thing. And I'm never going to understand it. I'm never going
to
take the time to figure it out. I could. I'm sure I could. But, like, ain't nobody got time for that.
Oh, no, wait. There are little labels here.
Yeah, there are even little labels.
Are those labels built in cells? I guess maybe they are.
I think they have to be.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I mean, it'd be breaking the game.
Right? Yeah.
Those labels have to be made of cells, I guess. Each little pixel in the label is a group of four dots.
Right. That'll
like
keep it alive.
A little square of dots that is apparently a stable thing in this world.
Yeah. Cool.
It's nuts, but it's cool.
So the original, I'm not sure exactly. I'm pretty sure that the original Game of Life was designed to be played by hand. You know, you sort of have put things down. There's a discussion of how to do this sort of safely by putting down black markers on things that are about to die, because everything has to sort of die and be born in the same instant.
Right.
It's just that would actually be a pretty horrible thing to be sentenced to make this digital clock by hand, like run each generation by hand.
It's like monks back in the old days had to copy huge texts for hand
right.
over and over and over again. It'd be like that. A lifetime of just like, okay, now we're going to calculate the next step in this. The last step only took us a year to do. This time, we could probably do it in 10 months.
Yeah. You get sort of handy with it. So. All right. Let's see if we can move off of that and talk about your space stuff here. That's pretty
right.
Cool.
Yeah, this is something that probably people have seen. I've seen it in many different forms in the past couple days. NASA fired up the old Voyager 1 thrusters for the first time in 37 years. So Voyager 1 is the farthest thing we have out in space. It's outside of our solar system. It's out in deep space. And they have some kind of... They have a couple different propulsion systems on board. And they have one, I forget what it's called, that is the main one that they've been using to adjust it to keep its antenna pointed back at Earth all the time. So they sent it commands to make micro adjustments. And I think at this point, each command takes almost 20 hours to get there.
Uh-huh.
And then 20 hours before we see the response. So it's pretty slow loop there. And what they found, though, was that the main propulsion system that they used to turn it was not working so well anymore. So they decided to fire up the main thrusters instead, which is not as efficient. I guess it uses a lot more fuel doing those. But it seems to have worked just fine. And so they're able to get the antenna pointing back at Earth again, which is what they want. So, and the interesting thing here was that the article on NASA's site that describes this says that the Voyager flight team dug up decades-old data and examined the software that was coded in an outdated assembler language to make sure we could safely test the thrusters. So it doesn't say which outdated assembler language, but it's kind of cool.
This kind of thing is just very freaky because, I mean, you mess it up just a little bit and it's just over. I mean, then it's pointed some other direction and it's not listening to you anymore.
Yep.
Oh.
Yeah, like it could so easily go wrong. And I think that NASA, at least normally for anything that's current missions, it's like ongoing stuff, they have simulators for everything so they can try everything out. I don't know if they have a good simulator for Voyager. Well, I guess they do. They must have some kind of simulator environment still for Voyager 1 and 2 to sort of try things out before they tell it to do something. But
yeah,
it's pretty crazy, though, just to think that these thrusters, which have not been fired in 37 years, still worked like a charm. Like, it's hard to imagine. Like, I could not assume that anything that I have anything that I have bought that is electronic or mechanical in my whole life would last 37 years, especially like 37 years in space, like
right.
Bombarded by radiation and, you know, probably tiny little rocks that are hitting things now and then. Just like, who knows what's going on up there? And like, yeah, fine. Thrusters on, no problem.
Yeah. Pretty very cool. So, well, congratulations to the whoever it is, Jet Propulsion Lab, I guess.
Yep.
Let's see. This also is, you know, not news or anything, the thing I'm going to talk about here, but I came across this thing called the cardiac computer. I forget exactly how I came across this, but at any rate, it is a it stands for Cardboard Illustrative Aid to Computation, and it is from 1969. It is a paper computer of a sort. So so there's a page that kind of describes this at drexel.edu, but sort of shows a picture of it. It's in a sort of 1969 teal color or whatever, ink. Basically what it is, it's a little book that you, or a little cardboard thing you slide open. It has little sliding rods on it. So there's a slider of input cards. There's a slider for the accumulator sign. And there's three sliders for the digits of an instruction in this little machine language. And there's a description of what the instruction set is. So there's input, you can read a card in, and clear accumulator, add from memory to accumulator. And then on the card itself, I think basically they slide these things around. There's a little actual picture of a, like a ladybug or whatever, that's supposed to indicate the program counter, where it is in memory. There's a 99, well, it's actually 97 decimal bytes of RAM, and 2 bytes of ROM. The very first one is the instruction to load the next thing, right? So
it can
boot itself, and then like you do this by hand, so it is a little bit like the, you know, like running life by hand,
right?
You figure out what the instruction would be, and then it tells you how to change stuff. You pencil in the memory space what the result is, and you move the little bug if you're supposed to. It's pretty wild.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I like this because it explains kind of how CPU works in a way, like in a very hands-on way. It's pretty cool. It's different from, we looked at some other paper computers that were more like physical, that were like, you cut things out and glue things together and get things moving and pushing the rods around and stuff. This is very different. This is more like just the logical model of a CPU and how it actually works with program code.
Yeah, and I think this probably does a better job of teaching you too.
Yeah.
You know, rather than just like, you know, I don't know, I hit put the marble up here and it went down there and it counted to 4 in the meantime. I don't know how that happened.
Right.
But
right. Whereas this, if you actually learn this and understand this, this is the basic underpinnings for understanding any assembly language. It's really, you know, the concepts are the same, identical. So,
which will get you far in designing iOS apps.
That's right. All the assembly.
But so there's an article in the, I guess, Bell Laboratories Record from July 1969, kind of talking about this. And it says, it's called Cardboard Computer Helps Students, Computers, in quotes. It's pretty interesting. But so I think part of what got me into this was that there someone wrote a CPU simulator in Python for this as well. So you can take a look at this. This is from 2014, but you can take a look at the simulator. And then there's also an assembler if you want to, you know, write some assembly programs, and there is some code on Bitbucket, some things that were written for the cardiac.
So, okay. Cool.
So, anyway, I don't think these are particularly easy to get. You'd think you could build it.
Right.
I didn't see anything on these pages that allow you to, like, sort of print out your own card set, but I bet it is figure-outable. I might actually be able to get my hands on one of them, but I'm not sure. I mean, like, this is the sort of thing that it's made from just, like, you know, junk cardstock, presumably, but yet it's got a historic nature to it that will probably make it very expensive to get a hold of.
Right. So. An original probably is hard to get hold of. But like I said, I think, you could make this.
Yeah.
We could reverse engineer this just by looking at it. There's not much going on here, really, I think.
I think that's true. Actually, looking at it, I think there's probably not actually any, there's not much at all on these little slidey things.
Right.
So, is that it?
Oh, you mentioned you also wanted to talk about Paleotronic.
Yes. So suddenly we've reached the end of the thing that I had. Maybe one other thing that is worth saying here is there's a Kickstarter for a retro technology magazine called Paleotronic. I don't know how long ago it started. We may be coming up on the end of a month. I'm not sure how long these usually are, but there's 5 days to go as we record, so it's probably like not very much time as you listen to this, but it's already made its goal, so it will happen. But what it is, it's basically a magazine examining the evolution and culture of electronics and computers through a retro-inspired yet modern-styled format. It's actually a print magazine, although it is available in digital copies as well. There's no issues have been made, but there's kind of like a sample of the kind of thing that would be in it. And it's totally the kind of thing that we talk about here. I mean, it's largely platform agnostic 8-bit type computing, but also one of the things, one of the sample articles is something on the Disky, the Apollo computer, right? And it's also paired with a emulator. So it's called the Micromate, I don't know, emulator, which I've seen the development of that going a bit. I forget, it used to be called something else, but the idea is that it's essentially kind of like a collaborative 8-bit emulator. It's supposed to allow basically sort of like collaborative programming and running and interacting between people on network connected machines. So the idea is actually that it's going to be very educational oriented, that kids from home can sort of work together on basic programming projects and that kind of thing. And it's their intention is for it to emulate a bunch of different systems. Right now it emulates an Apple II. And one of the things that they sort of show off about it is that it takes the pixels from an Apple II and extrudes them a little bit so that they're actual cubes. And then you can sort of zoom around. You can play games in 3D essentially in the sense that you can kind of like play it from behind the monitor or, have tilted in funny ways. So,
right.
But yeah, they're planning on extending that out, to emulate other platforms. And even right now, they have a lot of sort of basic examples and just just Apple II games you can play in 3D. So
right, which seems fun. I've not tried this yet. I've been meaning to, but it looks pretty cool. And one of the things that I think seems pretty exciting about this is they have, in their own words, compatible BASIC and logo interpreters rewritten in native Go, which provide additional command sets and user interface enhancements, local network, blah, blah, blah. So I guess the idea is that you can write software in Apple BASIC or Apple Logo or whatever, and which will have enhancements to let you do things like probably, maybe present a graphical menu, take mouse input, stuff like that, but that will still end up running within the interpreter or within the emulator in a sense. As with like some additional whatever, as additional sort of forms of input, or so it seems interesting. It's like an interesting approach to say, okay, we want to give people the opportunity to play with this old environment, but tack on some new stuff that makes it more appealing to connect with the world today. So
yeah,
kind of cool.
Does seem like a nice addition. I think I remember them saying something about adding to BASIC something that would let you like draw in the 3D world as well, like add a Z other than zero.
Right.
And it'd be fun to play with. It'd be kind of cool to just like be a kid again and have this. But
right.
Oh well, I'm happy enough with my actual Apple II experience. But all right, what do we do next? Oh yeah, the commercial.
You gotta pay the bills, Paul.
That's right. All right. So and now a word from our sponsor.
We asked Miss McDonald's class to show you our new Voyager, a special kind of wagon. With an electronic ignition system, a tighter turning diameter than its competition from Ford or Chevrolet.
What about me and my four children?
I'm going to have to sell the cattle ranch.
How much?
$200,000.
Oh.
I've got to pay my father-in-law $10,000.
Oh. All right, I buy insurance.
Decisions.
Oh, pay me.
Lawyer's salary, please.
There's a game called Life that's really worth living. You and your family.
When it comes to video games, nobody compares to Atari.
I find Intellivision more sophisticated and lifelike.
Gentlemen, move over for my friend Vic. The Commodore VIC-20.
Move over.
The Commodore VIC-20 does more than your machines. It's a great computer that also plays great games, like this, and this, and this.
A computer that plays great games?
Under $300?
Exactly.
We didn't know.
Get the Commodore VIC-20 computer for under $300.
And we're back. All right, so I have the responsibility of finding the host's gift idea, and this is actually an idea that I had put in anticipation of the episode that we would have recorded sort of around Halloween. But then we missed that one, and then the item I'm about to announce had too much demand, and so they'd closed down. So they're back, and so I'm going to pick this time some of the cases from RetroPie cases. So these are Raspberry Pi cases. We've seen others of this kind where you have, you know, some kind of vintage computer shape around your Raspberry Pi. These are pretty nice, though, and I haven't seen some of these. I have not seen any, you know, sort of competitors for. Mm-hmm. So there's a Commodore Amiga Raspberry Pi case, which I don't know actually what that one would look like. Is there an Amiga that has different colored keys like that?
Yeah, like they were different color, but they were not as different as this. So like all the function keys and shift and enter and escape and things were different on the Amiga. They were darker than the rest, but here they're kind of a medium dark gray and the rest of the keys are white, which is not quite what it looked like. But that's okay. It looks very cool anyway. I like it a lot.
Yeah, I like it. There's an Atari ST, which also looks quite pleasing.
Yeah.
There's a BBC Micro. BBC Micros are ugly, but they're so charming.
Yeah. In this form, it's pretty cute anyway.
Yeah. So, I mean, I totally want one. You know, they're super iconic, but I mean, they really, it's just like a box with this like weird red set of keys on it in the function area. But anyway, so all these are, they're about, I mean, I think maybe they're all $34 USD. Actually, you can get a Raspberry Pi Zero case that's a Commodore 64. Slightly cheaper.
Yeah, there seem to be two different sets of prices, what I see. I'm seeing them in Swedish kroner right now, and I see two different prices. Yeah, it looks like the Amiga and the ST ones and the BBC are $33.99, and the others are $39.99.
Oh, yeah. Look at that. Anyway. Okay, so between $27 and $40.
Yes.
And something comparable in Swedish kroner.
Right.
So, anyway, yeah, but it looks, they look quite nice. I mean, they're 3D printed and you can see that,
right.
But they look quite pleasant.
Yep. They look really good. Like, and especially I think the one that has like the best look in terms of color actually is the Atari ST one. Like that is the one that looks most genuine. Like they really got the color right. I feel like the Commodore 64, they don't quite have like the same kind of brown that they ought to have. But it's close. It's close. It's better than I would do.
Yeah.
So I won't knock it too much. But
right. But
the Atari ST is really dead on. It looks really nice.
So if you had one or know someone who did and you're looking for a gift, it is the gift-giving season, after all, or about to be. So there you go.
Nice.
Anyway, yeah, so like, this was going to be basically like a Halloween costume for your pie,
right?
Except that Halloween came and went.
Oops.
I kind of liked it anyway. All right. Well, okay. So with that out of the way, Jack, we can turn to eBay auctions, and you have. Oh, that's very pleasing. What is this?
Yes, I have one thing. I have the vintage Avon Beauty Vision Personal Color Computer. This is something that. It just happened. It popped up in my list of like
your Avon search
on eBay. Like there's a horizontal list of things that you might like because of things you searched for.
Right.
I'm like, what the hell is this? So basically, what it is, this is actually a Toshiba T1000. That's what it's based on, which is an MS DOS portable from the mid to late 80s, and it's put inside of a big plastic case. It has a number of additions to it. So, like, one thing, when you flip up the top of the case, it has It has a bunch of color swatches on the back. And also inside the case, there's kind of mounted inside is this device. I don't know what it is. It's attached to the computer by a cable. And it looks like it's something that you, I don't know if you point this at a person's skin to sort of measure the color of their skin. I guess that's what it is. So I guess the point of this is that you run some software that's going to tell you which colors of makeup are suitable for this person to use. So probably salespeople had this as like a high-tech way of selling their Avon beauty products to sort of say, okay, they take out this wand and point it at you and say, okay, you've got this skin color. Well, you should use this kind of pink for your eyeshadow and this kind of blue for your cheeks or whatever. Maybe those aren't the right colors for eyeshadow and cheeks, but I'm no expert. Anyway,
that's cool. So it's a very different take on what color computer means.
Right, it's a whole different kind of color computer because it's actually got a monochrome display, but it computes a set of colors for you to use. So kind of interesting. And the seller says that he fired it up and it seemed to work as a computer. He said there was there's a printer attached to it also. I don't really see the printer in here in the box, but it's somewhere in there, I guess. There's a printer. And so the printer seemed kind of iffy, but maybe just needs cleaning. He didn't really check it out much. Oh, right. Okay, yeah. Now I see the printer. It looks like a roll of paper inside of something. I guess it's like kind of like a receipt printer kind of thing. But the computer itself seems to work. He said there the row of function keys are covered by a piece of plastic, which you can pry off if you want to. So if you just want to buy this and rip out the Toshiba T1000 and use that, you can do that for only right now $60. Buy it now.
It's weird enough. It might almost be, it might almost be it's not that expensive, and there are 8 available.
Right.
So, which is pretty wild. Yeah. So you can see on the screen, it says, John, your skin has pink undertones.
Right.
Your most natural skin tone category is ultra cool.
Ultra cool.
I think that's probably not actually how you're supposed to pronounce it, but
ultra cool.
Yes. Excellent.
So that's what I found. That's the good thing I found. And I also wanted to say, last time we talked, I was just complaining about eBay. I didn't actually find any things to sell, to try and buy. I was just complaining about not being able to buy stuff. And I actually, one of our listeners, Vic, who is on the 10 Pence Arcade, he wrote me on Twitter saying, hey, I heard you're having trouble buying an Atari 7800. I was going to offer you to buy one of my spares. But before he did that, I'd already actually bought one off of eBay. I actually managed to get one of my sales at a good price. I'm pretty happy with it. Did not have a power supply, so we got to work that out. But it's fine, I think. I hope it's fine.
Cool.
As far as I know, it works. I just have no way to test it yet, but I'll get it working.
So congratulations on getting it.
Thank you.
So you're saying it arrived already?
Yeah, I guess it was a week ago yesterday is when I won the auction. And then it arrived here on Friday, all the way from Italy.
Cool.
So, yeah, it's cool. Seems good. So far, so good. I mean, it arrived. It seems to be in one piece. There are cartridges.
So it's a more advanced game console, right?
Right. So this is... So Atari, they had like the console that they had, the famous one, the 2600. And they had a follow-up called the 5200, which is actually kind of a repackaged Atari 8-bit computer. And so the software for those is essentially the same. It's not identical, but very, very similar. And they were preparing another machine called the 7800. And in 1984, when everything went south and Jack Tramiel bought the company and said, well, we're not going to mess with video games anymore, he just sort of shelved that. And then a few years later, when Nintendo proved that you still definitely can sell video game consoles in America, then Atari launched this. I think it was about 1987. So it was not quite as good as, say, the NES in terms of graphics and stuff. It's better than the other early Atari consoles, but not good enough to defeat the NES in some sense. Like, I think it had a lot of sprites, but it didn't have the facility for, like, tile-based rendering of backgrounds, which was kind of, that was the big technical breakthrough in the NES, was the tile-based stuff, which let you make these nice scrolling games all over the place. So anyway, it never really went anywhere in the marketplace. And I remember in the early 90s, this outlet place called Federated Electronics, which I'm pretty sure was owned by Atari at the time, they were selling bundles of these, like an Atari 7800 with I don't know, a load of games, and it was like $100, maybe $150, and I thought about it and didn't buy it, and then years later kicked myself saying, I should have bought that damn thing. But
right.
Oh, well. Yep. The sins of youth, not buying things I should have.
Now you're rectifying that in some way. So.
Yeah, so that's right. Good. Wait, I actually have one more thing to add about this.
Okay.
Just to throw it in here. So the system that they sold in the U.S., I remember it had like a two-button joystick, unlike the original Atari joystick. So it had like, you could have more advanced games that required two buttons. But it's sort of like you held the joystick in one hand, you had the base of the joystick in one hand, and there was a button on either side, kind of like for your thumb and index finger, I guess, and a joystick on top. But the one they sold in Europe, which is the one I bought, the PAL version, it must have been something they reworked after the success of the Nintendo, and they figured, oh, well, we should have something like a joypad instead, like the NES. Mm. And so this one came in with the joypads, which came in with this one. And they're just like the most terrible, mushy controls. Like, ugh, I can't. So I haven't played any games with it yet. I haven't really tried, but just like picking up the feeling of these things, it's like, oh, geez, like how could this even like, ugh. Like it just feels like you have no sense of if you're pushing it hard enough or at all, or just like it's just very unpleasant. Boo, Atari.
Yeah. Oh, well.
But I mean, I have other things I can plug into it instead, so it's fine. So, but
sure,
I'm not worried.
And I mean, they were trying to you know, mass produce these things, so everything was cheap as could be, I'm sure.
Right. Yeah.
So. Well, okay, so I as usual, have a pile of things, which I think I will skip around in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So the first one I wanted to just point out, I don't think I've ever talked about this before, and I don't know anything about it, but it's called an Atrona Attaché, and it's a luggable type computer, but it's smaller, actually, than most of the ones that I've come across, mm-hmm. and it's in this nice color, nice sort of like brown, orange, yellow color scheme. Mm-hmm. It's a tan box that has a little built-in screen. I can't tell if it's two or one. Might be two. Disk drives next to it, so it looks a little bit like like the little compact portables,
mm-hmm.
but it's just kind of cute.
Yeah, it is cute. It's kind of adorable.
It has some kind of 8/16 option card in it. I don't know what that means. It essentially turns the computer. Oh, I see. Right. So, I got it. So it's a CPM machine, basically, but it has a card in it that will allow you to run MS-DOS.
Okay.
So, actually, that's not bad.
Nice. I really like the look of this keyboard.
Yeah.
It looks actually really cool. Like, oh, man. I would enjoy typing on that keyboard.
But, and unless the keys are really big, then it is actually quite small.
Right.
This thing. I mean, that's got to be like a 4-inch screen or something.
Right,
like that.
Yeah, the screen is. But I mean, you know, we're staring at iPhones also, right? Those are the screens not much bigger. So, and it being a CRT, it's probably, you know, green on black, whatever. It's probably decently bright.
Oh, I see. Actually, yeah, the photos do show it on.
So
that looks reasonable enough.
Yeah,
and multiple levels of brightness. Yeah. So
cool.
Well, yeah, it's kind of tempting, but it ends in 5 days. From when we record, so hopefully this will be out before then.
Right.
The current bid is $20.50, and to me it would be shipping $58, so it's reasonable.
Yeah. It's in Spring, Texas, so if you're in Spring, Texas, you can probably skip that shipping.
The next thing I wanted to mention was this thing called a Vintage Macrotronics Terminal. And this is a weird thing. There's one person watching it, and I think it is me. So it caught my attention. It's just kind of a box. It has like a little wood grain, you know, wood panel back to it. It has a DC milliampere little indicator on the right. Someone has stuck an Apple computer sticker in the middle of it, which is just one of the ones that comes with, you know, that came with the computers back in the day.
Right.
And then there's a little switch on the left. And it's basically just this box. You can plug it in. There's a little ribbon cable that comes out of the back that is plugging into an interface card. That's sort of an anonymous looking interface card. And so I went to look up, you know, what is this thing? I mean, like, it's really unclear what it is. It has a user port interface in the back as well. What it actually is basically for serial communication over the radio waves.
Oh.
So you connect it to your shortwave set or whatever, and it will send I think it will send various, you know, it will encode ASCII into bits that it can send across and, mm-hmm. and translate back and things like that. I saw an ad for it as a device for the TRS-80 Model 1. Mm-hmm. And I saw almost nothing else about this. This card, it is recognizably, I believe, a serial card for an Apple II.
Okay.
And the fact that it has an Apple sticker on the front of it suggests it's a reasonable interpretation.
Right.
Who knows what software you use? I mean, like, it's quite possible that any terminal software would be good enough to just communicate with this box. Mm. Presumably, you plug this box into your shortwave somehow. But I
guess through the user port, but I don't really.
Yeah, that's you anticipated my concern. Like, I see no way. There's nothing to connect. There's like a little toggle switch. The user port, I would have assumed, goes to a computer like the TRS-80 101. Mm. Like, I'm assuming that this is actually some kind of hacked version. You know, ham radio operators, you can't trust them not to hack something.
True.
So it's probably something designed for the TRS-80 Model 1 with this ribbon cable going in and intercepting whatever signals coming through from the user port, except user port to me sounds like Commodore terminology. Hmm. So I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know what this thing is, but the thing I think is weirdest is I don't know where you connect the audio signal.
No.
There's no jack of any sort.
I mean, it's got to be the user port. It can't be anything else. So maybe that had something that was another ribbon cable coming off of it that would go to something and maybe come, you know, terminate in kind of a breakout box to plug in something else.
Yeah.
That's what I would kind of guess, but I don't know. Mm.
So if somebody wants to get this and experiment with it and tell us, that'd be great. It's a buy it now for $40, and I've looked at it. I've been tempted. If it's gone, I might have bought it. but the thing is, I don't know what I can do with it.
Do you have ham radio equipment?
I do not. And this seems like a bad way to get into it.
But Earl has ham radio stuff, right?
Yeah, I think he might.
We should get Earl to buy this and tell us what it is.
Yeah.
If we let one of those sponsors who loves our episodes article post their Android news, then we could buy this for Earl and let him tell us what it is.
Sounds exactly perfect. But yeah, so this may well miss people's searches just because there's not, like, it has no keywords in it.
Right.
So anyway, so if you were looking for one of these, there is one. It's a buy it now that's for like a month. So. Yep. Let's see. So the other thing I wanted to, one other one I wanted to mention is there's a NEC PC 8200 system, so this is basically the same family as the TRS-80 Model 100. This might actually be sort of like an earlier, like, I think this is more directly the company that created it, mm-hmm. and then Radio Shack bought the design. But so, I mean, these are their own things and is sort of a separate line, but I think they're compatible. And what's kind of cool about this one, I mean, so it looks nice. But it comes with, pretty much everything. And the AC adapter, all the little panels seem to be there in the back. There's a battery cartridge and there's a box, looks like a box.
Mm-hmm.
It's beat up in the same way that these boxes get beat up,
sure.
But looks not bad. All the manuals are there. A cassette, which I guess actually contains software. It says a personal application kit. Oh, yeah, a PC8201A software. But yeah, manuals for the basic, for the machine, and for the application kit on tape. Mm-hmm. It has the little pouch that you carry it in. So it's basically just complete. It's the summary of this.
Right.
It has everything you would have basically if you bought it new. And so it looks pretty cool. It's starting bid of $25. No one has started bidding on it yet.
Neat.
So anyway, yeah, take a look at it if you're interested. I would have been interested except that I have one already.
Yeah.
So I don't, I mean, the box is, I have one of the boxes and it looks about the same shape. So it would be irresponsible of me to get just a second one.
Right.
But they are kind of cool.
The one comment I have about this is looking at the pictures of the device itself, the front of the screen, along the top, there's like a weird like line of grunge Like, it's like one of these things where, okay, come on, a basic little wipe down of this to remove the sort of fuzzy grime along the top.
Yeah, it's weird. It does seem like they did wipe it down kind of as the photos progressed. So by the time you get to the later ones,
it's a little better later on.
but yeah, it really looks like fur.
Yeah. fuzzy old computer.
Yeah, I have actually quite a lot of machines from this platform. You know, the basically related to the TRS-80 model 100 I just haven't gotten around to it. I would kind of like to play with them, but they came in a couple different. So the actual Radio Shack ones, they came in the Model 100, which was the first one, and then the 102, which is kind of like a little slimmed down one. But then they actually made a couple of sort of laptop looking ones. So there was the Model 200, which actually had a little fold up screen and a keyboard underneath it, and then the 600. Of which I have three for some reason, that actually had a 3.5-inch disc built in. So it's, by that point, it's turned into a whole kind of laptop computer, but with all the power of a Model 100. So,
nice.
Oh, well. Okay, then the next thing I will mention, I think we talked about this probably a month ago, but there was a Intellivision computer module.
Right.
And here's another one, and I just think they look kind of cool.
Yep.
I keep thinking that they're rare, and yet, this is the second time in 3 months we're talking about it.
Right. Yeah, I really don't have any idea how rare these things are. I know that I've never...
They look rare, though, don't they?
I've never seen one in person, but I like the box. It's half pink. It's pretty hot pink. Half hot pink. How about that?
Yep.
Pretty sweet.
Yeah, it looks nice. You know, it looks sort of like... I don't know. It looks like the 80s to me.
Right.
So
this one seems to be mostly all wrapped up in bubble wrap and stuff. And there's even a photo of the box, showing where it's been taped. It's kind of nice. But it's not really a good close-up of the device itself. It's all bubble wrapped.
Right. Right.
But it's probably fine.
Oh, well, okay. So it's rare enough that $110 buy it now is considered appropriate.
Mm.
But actually, at least for me, it's free shipping. So, for the box and everything really looking in that shape, that's probably not crazy if you're into this sort of thing.
Yeah.
All right. Last couple of things I will mention. One is just a cool looking thing. It is a Burroughs B90 mainframe 8-inch floppy drive. Super rare vintage, it says.
Mm.
But I don't know, if we can believe that. This is one of those things that, for me, this is just decorative.
Sure.
But I don't have anything Burroughs, and actually the cables have been cut on the back, so
yeah, adding to the firm decorative stance.
Yeah,
slice those cables right off.
I mean, I think it's conceivable that the mechanism inside, is a relatively standard 8-inch drive that you could connect to some kind of controller. But I think it looks pretty. I'm kind of torn about this because I think Burroughs old big computers, nice big square thing. It's got kind of it looks like it's got a sort of like a smoked translucent glass cover.
Mm-hmm.
Not glass, but plastic, I mean.
Right.
And it's got a nice blue bar. I don't know what the blue bar is for. Maybe it's for eject, and a red and a blue button that look like they light up. And yet, it's somehow right on the edge of being pretty. It's not quite there. So, anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess to be fair, almost every other 8-inch drive I've ever seen is much uglier.
Right. For being an 8-inch drive, this thing is it's 10.
Yeah. Right. But anyway, so if you're on the market for this, this is not cheap. $130 buy it now. And they would charge me $82 to ship it, which is pretty rough.
Yikes.
But anyway. Okay, and then the last thing I'm going to mention is a C64 Wi-Fi modem. So this is, I think there are probably a couple of things that are kind of like this, but this has a nice little package. It connects to the, I think the little, user port type connector at the back of your Commodore. Has the nice little Wi-Fi logo on it and the, I don't know what you call the little radar symbol thing. They show some screenshots of an actual Commodore, you know, connecting to BBSs that are showing color and things like this. So it's a modern device, but it's kind of nicely made. It is 34 British pounds, so 46-ish US dollars, shipping out of somewhere in the UK.
Right.
WORCS.
Works.
Works. So anyway, there are three available now, although the picture shows a pile of, looks to be nine. So, you know, whatever. I think it might be worth getting a hold of one of these if you're interested in something like this. I think it's probably not, this is about as cheap as they come.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I think if this is something that you want to have, this is probably, seems like a very good price for it. I wonder, who the seller of this is. Like, I'm thinking just because they seem to have had a pile of them. I wonder if this is someone who's actually making these or someone who's just buying bunches of stuff from whoever's making it.
My guess is that they are actually the ones who make them.
What does it show you as the shipping price?
It shows me 12.50 British pounds.
That's what it shows me also. 17. And I was about to say, ha, it's cheaper here in your face for the first time ever. But no, I have the exact same price.
Sorry.
Oh, well.
Yeah, so the description says, new from the developer of microcassette, I guess, but it doesn't actually say, I am that developer
right.
anywhere in here. So,
I guess I've heard of these devices being available, having a standard serial connection, and then it's a Wi-Fi device that acts like a modem, so you give it AT commands with an IP address instead of a number. But I haven't really seen ones like this where they actually are platform specific, like that you plug right into a C64 or an Atari or anything. Like, I don't know. Maybe the Commodore has a roughly standard serial port built in. I don't know. It might. I know that for sure, like the Atari didn't, but C64 maybe. I don't really know. Not sure the port situation there.
I think it must, because I'm pretty sure that the disk drive was a serial device. I think you just you said, you know, please give me sector 8, and it gave you sector 8.
Mm. Right.
You know, so. So the famously slow 1541 drives, I think, had their own 6502 in them.
Right.
Or something like that. So, didn't the Atari drives too?
Yeah, they were also had their own controller in them. Because those were on the Atari SAO, which is kind of like a forerunner to USB in some sense. It's like a daisy chain, you know, plug and play sort of thing. But then the Atari had no standard serial port or parallel port, so if you wanted to do that, you had to buy an interface that would plug in, and that itself cost a couple hundred bucks, and
yeah,
not much fun
back then.
Yeah.
Now, of course, you can't avoid getting them whenever you buy anything Atari.
Well, actually, no, those
in one of those.
Those things are actually
850 or something like
that. Yeah, the 850. Those are actually they still cost something. They're not free.
No, I think the thing is that whenever I've looked at I don't know, if I'm looking at an 800 lot or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, they all have them.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I don't need any more.
If you're looking at a big lot where someone actually had a lot of stuff, they probably had an 850. Because as soon as you wanted to have, like, a standard Hayes modem or something, you needed to have something like that.
Right. Oh, well. Anyway, okay. So, if you're in the market for one of these, as usual, you might want to get it soon. Just because who knows how long they'll last in the world. So, and okay, I'll leave it there. That was enough eBay exploration for this fortnight. So, I guess we can go to the sort of closing notes. What are your closing notes?
Yeah, the only thing I want to mention is not related to retro stuff at all necessarily, but just about computing and programming. There's an event called Advent of Code, which has been going on for a few years now, and the idea is that during the days of December leading up to Christmas, you have some programming challenges to do, and you can sort of do them in whatever language you want. Basically, it gives you sort of a puzzle and gives you an input set and expects an answer back from you. And so you can write your code however you want to write it, whatever system you want to use. If you want to write this in Apple Basic, you could. And then you just you post the answer back, and it sort of verifies, yep, you got the right answer. And there's kind of a leaderboard and stuff, so like the first couple hundred people who actually answer things right each day get points, but there are way too many people doing this for me to be able to get that on time. Plus, I think the answer, the puzzles come out when it's 5 a.m. here, so I'm not doing that. But it's pretty fun. We're only on day 3 right now as we're recording this, and I have done the first couple of days, and it's been fun. I've seen this in previous years, but I haven't tried it out. And it's sort of, it's kind of stuff that, you know, when you were a kid and you were learning programming and you bought a book about how to do BASIC or whatever, and there might be puzzles like that in here. Like, it's kind of like, it's about how to sort of, you've got a big array of numbers and you've got to do something with them, find something in there, do a checksum, that kind of thing. So it's kind of fun. Nothing super challenging, but it's fun to just sort of do.
I would get extra points for writing it on a cardiac.
You would not get the speed points.
No, exactly. Probably, and the answer would get turned in next year. But cool. Yeah, I feel like I've heard of that before, but I really have not paid any attention to it. Yeah. So, well, let's see. For me, not a whole lot is going on. It's just sort of the end of the academic semester and also the end of, like, you know, cold season. So, you know, I'm just, somehow I managed to get 2 colds. How is that even possible? But I sort of recovered in between. And anyway, so my ability to speak is actually quite recent. I actually was kind of completely unable to talk a couple days ago. So, but let's see. So I had to go through this transaction a couple of days ago when I could barely talk, but I got just recently a fairly large kind of set of Apple II stuff. One of the things that was in it was an Epson MX-80 printer, though, which I thought was pretty cool. I didn't have one before. I mean, this is the first one that I have in my sort of current life, although they were all over the place when I was a kid. So this is the, I think it was basically the first version of this like super iconic printer that was everywhere. You know, tractor feed.
Right.
You know, Epson box.
Yeah. I remember this. I never had one, but I definitely remember this printer. Like you said, these were kind of all over the place. It's kind of a standard model.
Yeah. So, and what's cool is I have the box, you know, I have the manual, I have, you know, just like it used to be. Mm-hmm. Even came with, I think, a little spider nest. But at any rate, so that was pretty cool. Also was digging around and found my Palm 7X, which is a little wireless thing that I won from essentially like a Palm App Store in 2001.
Okay.
So that was kind of cool.
How'd you win it?
I think I was just, I don't know, I bought something and got drawn in a lottery.
Okay, cool.
You know, so at the time I was using a Palm 3XE, I think was my primary device. And so there were 2 main stores. One was Handango.
Sure
that's how it was supposed to be. How did I think about it? Then there was one other one, and I forget what that one was called.
I forget.
Is that familiar to you?
Yeah, I was doing Palm stuff that in those days too, but I've forgotten what the sites were.
Yeah. Right. But anyway, I bought something, and then they emailed me and said, "You have won, you know, a Palm 7X. Mm. You know, where can we send it?" And you know, at that time, that wasn't just like, actually, they did send me one. Yeah. Like, it wasn't some sort of weird spam phishing attempt or something. So
actually, that was pretty cool,
actually, though, because the 7X was it was a wireless one, so I subscribed to PalmNet, and I could check my email on the train and use this like weird little confined special web space that they made for it.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I remember at that time I had a handspring visor, and I had through that a Bluetooth connection to my phone, like my Sony Ericsson phone, and I had must have been either 2G or Edge, but I could, there was some application on the Palm. I forget what it's called. It was similar to this kind of web clipping thing where it would actually talk to its own service, and it didn't cost anything. I forget, it was a certain browser that ran on Palm OS, and it would talk to something that would like trim out other stuff that was not going to work, like, or just unnecessary stuff to just make pages small. And it actually worked. I mean, reading articles on the web on, just like I said, like on the bus or on the train, on my Palm through my phone, it was a little bit slower than reading stuff on my phone today. But on the other hand, like that these days, web pages, every web page you download from any big site is, you know, a couple of megabytes or whatever. Like there's just so much overhead and everything that comes down that like that seems to have balanced out the increase in speeds of networks and devices. Like, oh, now just load up with more stuff to make it as slow as it was almost 20 years ago.
Yeah, you know, I often think about that in terms of like set-top cable boxes. It's like no matter how powerful that hardware is, we're going to push like 150% of what it can do. So every menu takes, you know, 20 seconds to draw.
Yeah. Somewhere they gotta learn how to like measure what they're doing and find some proper balance. Yeah.
I remember I did something sort of similar with the 3XE that I had a connector. The Palm connection kit, you know, would connect to my cell phone, and I had a Go type or some sort of, or maybe it was just the Palm keyboard that folded out. Mm. So I had this like very elaborate, you know, the like cell phone's on that little tray table. It was a very elaborate setup I had there when I was riding the train.
Nice.
And you know, I was the only one that was doing anything right. Like this. I mean, like, and it just really, it really actually looks very strange. To have a, like, basically a full-size keyboard with like this little nubbin of a screen sticking out the middle, but oh well. Anyway, it was pretty cool to see it. I had someone on Twitter had seen that they'd picked up one of these at a some sort of flea market kind of thing, and so I thought I had one of these. Went and located it. It was I brought it somewhere anyway, but I had it in this like super unbelievably. Strong case. It's like this steel case that has padding inside to cushion the blow, and it has a holster.
Good.
So I don't know who exactly they were imagining when they built this thing, but I wore it.
Sure. Yeah, I remember having holstered Palm devices also on my hip. Felt pretty cool, pretty badass.
That's right. I can just make an appointment whenever I want. Stand back,
oh,
world.
Man. This is the days. King of the world.
But anyway.
Well, so this Palm 7X, though, now does it actually, if you fire it up, will it connect to anything? Does it, like, how does it do?
I didn't put in the battery, so I don't know. But my belief is that it no longer has a endpoint to connect to.
Right.
So I don't think it was, I think it was pretty proprietary. It might have been, you know, carried on something that was more universal. And so like it might connect with Edge or whatever it is. But I don't think I would know if it did because it's not going to connect to anything.
Right.
Cause I think PalmNet was the only way that you could do anything with that antenna.
Okay.
So, and Palm itself is gone now, yeah. I think. Right.
I think.
So.
Cool. You found it anyway.
Yep. Yep. So maybe this summer I'll try it out or over the break or something, but one other thing I wanted to mention, which I probably could have mentioned in the news, but there's a very cool cross stitch project that someone named Glenda Adams put together, which is it's basically a cross stitch of a screenshot of the game Ultima 1. I'm sure people are all, you know, at least vaguely familiar with the existence of the Ultimas, you know, graphic role playing game, tile based role playing game. But this is actually. This is an actual cross-stitch rendition of the Apple II screen. And what I think is the coolest about this, I mean, it looks perfect, is that it looks perfect. And so specifically, she's put in this, like, the fringing, the color fringing on the edges of the letters where,
right.
You know, if it ended on an even column, then it fringed red,
yeah.
Or sorry, blue, I guess.
Little blue and orange fringes.
Yeah. I mean, and it looks exactly like it would if you were looking at the actual screen.
Yep.
There's a place in the water's blue, and then there are these little green bushes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a place where there's a blue dot right next to a green dot.
Mm-hmm.
And if that ever happens on an Apple II, that turns them white.
Right.
And so there's like this one little white dot,
yep.
in the bush where these things meet. It's very pleasing.
Yep. Very authentic.
We'll have links to those.
Nicely done.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I've seen this as well. I'm in awe.
Yep. All right. Anyway, I guess that's enough for now. Thank you, everybody, for coming along with us on this binary journey. But, all right, so that'll be it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. And not just discuss us, you can discuss vintage computing. That's probably better as a discussion topic for there. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast and join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCRpodcast. You can send us feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com, and that will give us something to read other than the solicitations for externally written articles. We are a member of the Throwback Network, which is at throwbacknetwork.net. And if you have a chance, please write a review on iTunes. That will help other people find the show. And I guess until next time,
Retro Compute.